Good afternoon, everyone. And this morning, reflecting a bit about conditionality and the way various processes in our minds and bodies condition each other. I thought I'd just elaborate a little bit with that. Not too much, but so I, at the end, talked about how the instructions that I was offering, what I was saying this morning, could be thought of kind of like Dharma rain, you know, just kind of entering into the field of your minds, it's as a condition, the Dharma, the teachings from the Buddha entering into our minds is a condition that affects what happens for us in our practice. And so just reflecting a little bit on the conditions, that we are cultivating conditions that support moving us in the direction of freedom. And that those conditions include observing the conditions that lead us toward suffering. So the conditions that lead us towards freedom are the observation of the conditions that lead us toward suffering. And so the practice, you know, we can do the practice, we can engage with it, and in fact, it's like this is how the whole practice unfolds. Like we hear a teaching, we hear something, we hear about mindfulness. Maybe in that process, something sparks an interest. Whether or not it sparks an interest is also conditioned based on our upbringing, our conditioning, our proclivities, our openness to various thoughts or ideas. And if it sparks an interest, then perhaps we start to engage. Perhaps we because these teachings are not just about believing, you know, the teachings are about engagement. And so you know, we can't just hear the teachings and expect some kind of anointing of ta-da, there's freedom. That the teachings describe a way to make effort. And so there is something that we pick up, that we do. In this practice, what we pick up and do is pretty minimal. Again, this morning I pointed to just the simplicity of being aware, noticing what's obvious, and checking the attitude. And in that awareness, the kind of the curiosity, the allowing of what's here, the curiosity of how the mind how the conditions of the mind unfold, that kind of the way of observing is what supports the freedom. It's not just any old kind of observing, it's the way of observing. And so this is a condition. We learn something about how to observe our minds and our bodies. And then it's a little bit of a closer and closer approximation to that. A closer and closer approximation to wise mindfulness, a closer and closer approximation to the mind with wise view, wise attitude. And yet the whole process begins with the condition of hearing the Dharma dropped into our system. Somehow that happens for us. And so the instructions and the practice are both conditions that support freedom. There's a way that that freedom is described as the unconditioned. And that's something that I've reflected on and that other teachers have talked about, this interesting kind of almost paradox that there are conditions that support our mind's ability to open to what's described as unconditioned. So how might that work? I like Thanissaro Bhikkhu's analogy of this, or description, a simile that kind of elaborates on this. He said, the Grand Canyon is an amazing place. It's a beautiful expanse. And you can walk, you can follow a trail. Somebody stumbled on the Grand Canyon first, you know, without having a path. But now there are many paths that lead to the Grand Canyon. And so somebody can tell you, there's this amazing place, you should go and see it. Follow this path and you'll get there. And so you can walk on the path pretty reliably following the path, unless you get distracted by some kind of, you know, event here or there, or some cool flower or plant and go wandering off the trail. If you follow the path, if you follow the instructions, you'll arrive at the Grand Canyon. And so following the path is the condition for the experience of the Grand Canyon. But following the path did not create the Grand Canyon. The Grand Canyon was there, whether or not the path was followed. The Grand Canyon was there before there were even paths to be followed. So this is a kind of, partly an encouragement. The Buddha describes his teaching as a path that will open us to a release from the patterns, the habits of suffering that our minds have ensnared us in, entranced us by, enchanted us into believing that they lead to happiness. I'm debating about whether to offer another reflection on conditionality from the teachings of the Buddha. Maybe I will. This is more think of the Buddha sometimes as an amazing psychologist in terms of uncovering the workings of the mind, how the mind does what it does and how it entraps us into our patterns and habits of suffering, of dukkha. And there's a teaching, and actually in the suttas it's described, I believe, as being from Shariputra. No, Mahakasapa. Kachana. Mahakachana. So the Buddha offered a kind of a brief teaching, and then it was a kind of cryptic lesson, and the monks kind of were curious about, what does that mean? And so they asked, and the Buddha went off to rest, and they asked this other monk, Mahakachana, what did he mean by this? And Mahakachana gave a teaching about conditionality. And the teaching is in the Sutta Majjhima 18. It's called the Honeyball Sutta. And it really talks about the processes at work in our mind and how they interact. And how the processes of, well, the interaction too, of the processes of body with the processes of mind. And then how the processes of mind kind of take over and start to confuse us, we could say. So I'll just say the teaching. Many of you have heard this teaching, so it's just hearing the words of the Buddha again. So the Mahakachana goes through the six sense bases, and I'll express this through just one of the sense bases. Dependent on the eye and forms, eye consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is contact. So this is the bare sense experience. And the conditionality of that bare sense experience. Sight doesn't arise unless there is an eye, a functioning eye, with consciousness. So these three are interdependent, so there's conditionality here, just in the arising of sight, just the bare arising of sight. Dependent on the eye and forms, eye consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is contact. With contact as condition, there is feeling. What one feels, that one perceives. So with the experience of sight, there's not only the sight itself, but there's feeling. Is it, you know, there's a feeling, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And with that feeling, so, you know, my understanding here is like what one feels, that one perceives. Those kind of happen together. Some of the Abhidhamma teachings talk about contact, feeling, perception arising together. So there's a contact of sight, and then there's feeling and perception. And this kind of points to the contact or the meeting of the sense base, having a feeling. And that feeling, my understanding, is in the mind. It's not in the sense base itself. It's a process. It's a mental process. So it's not a physical process. It's a mental process. And that process of feeling is kind of like what lets us know there's been some contact. I think that's kind of what's being pointed to here. And then with that kind of contact and feeling, the mind orients towards recognizing it. That's what perception is. And so again, these are conditioned processes at work. I was just describing this morning of kind of the curiosity of noticing the difference between body and mind. So there's a sight, and then there's a feeling associated with sight, and there's a perception associated with that. So the sight, form and color, a feeling of maybe pleasant, and kind of arising with that is a perception. What is being seen? Perception might be at a very simple level of just like green or brown, jagged. And then layered on top of that might be another perception of tree. Again, these are mental. conditioned unfolding of just our human apparatus. All of this part is just our human apparatus doing its job. Not what we're not trying to stop it. We're not trying to change it or fix it. But what the Buddha points out, or what the teaching here points out, the Buddha actually blesses this teaching later in the teaching. He says, yes, Mahakachana knows his stuff, so think of this as my words. So in this teaching, what I think partly is being pointed to is it's useful to understand that these are processes at work. To not be seduced or enchanted by or pulled into believing something is something that it is not. Because very often in this process of perceiving a tree, you know, we pick that up and we do something with it. As I talked about this morning, it's not just a tree. There becomes the concept of the tree and what relationships I have with trees and when I saw a tree like that before, and that all kind of comes in. And this is what the teaching goes on to point to, actually, because the next thing, what one feels, that one perceives. What one perceives, that one thinks about. So we see the tree and we start thinking about it. This is very normal. Oh, what kind of tree is that? Out my window, I'm seeing a palm tree. Palm tree. Okay. That, again, is that's a kind of a perception, but then the mind starts thinking about, I wonder what kind of animals live in that palm tree, or who cleans those branches off the bottom of the palm tree, or various thoughts about the palm tree. Now, none of those may have a particular kind of stickiness to it. It's just like, oh, they're just kind of random thoughts, you know, associative nature of our minds in a way. So we think about something, we perceive something, and then our minds start pulling in other ideas, thoughts about that. The next place is where it starts to get sticky. What one feels, that one perceives. What one perceives, that one thinks about. What one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates. That term that's translated as mental proliferation is translating the term papancha, which often is translated, and mental proliferation may sound like a lot of thinking, like where the mind kind of charges out into a rambunctious thought about the palm tree. That can happen, definitely. The mind, with its associations and all of its relationships with things, and this can particularly happen with people, you know, with relationships. You know, we see somebody and it may be that we don't know the person, but they remind us of somebody that we have a relationship with, and there the not only are we seeing this person, we may not even be consciously aware that they're reminding us of this other person, but it kind of pulls in a whole bunch of conditions related to our relationship with that other person. And maybe we start to judge that person, thinking, oh, that person's this way or that way, and we know nothing about them. We see this on residential retreat when we're wandering around and noticing our kind of views and beliefs about people, that all we see is how they pick up their spoon and stir their tea, and we've got a whole story about them. So this is a form of papancha that our mind is kind of proliferating and picking up without even being aware. It's picking up history and prior conditioning based on like how tall the person is or something like that. You know, just some feature of the person may be triggering a kind of a connection with some of these histories. So this is a way that papancha works, that kind of the baggage that gets pulled in to our relationships to things. But another way that I think that is actually pointed to by Papancha is not necessarily as a proliferation of any kind of thinking, but more as the kind of the delusion that creeps in around the kind of the reality of that perception or concept as a thing, kind of a reification or a belief in the thoughts that we're having as truth. Kind of it might even be really simple, just as like, yes, that is a tree. It could just be that simple, that kind of that belief that what I am seeing is this tree, and that tree is an independently existing thing from me. And I'm not saying actually that there's nothing out there. I do actually think that there are things out there, but the only way that we experience things is through this mediation of the mind. And we cannot experience what is actually out there. We cannot experience that. What we experience is a construct of our minds. And because of that, because what we experience is a construct of our minds, there's all this room for beliefs and delusions to enter in to those concepts and skew our perception, skew our view of what's happening out there based on those beliefs. And so this whole notion of belief, of kind of believing our perceptions or concepts to be truth, this is a piece of Papancha. And it may not be a lot of thought. It may be just like really just a subtle sense of, yeah, this is right. This is true. And then the sutta goes on to point to that with what we have proliferated, with what one has mentally proliferated, that then affects how we perceive everything else. And so the statement is, with what one has mentally proliferated as the source, perceptions and notions tinged by mental proliferation beset one with respect to past, present, and future forms cognizable through the eye. And so this is pointing out that, you know, Papancha is not just simply something that's a one-off thing. It actually goes on to shape and influence how we take in, how we receive information, how we perceive things is influenced by our views and beliefs. And so this becomes a cycle. And so the next thing that we perceive based on the eye and forms, eye consciousness arises. Already there's a filter in there. Already there's a view. Already there's a belief that is shaping how we perceive that, how we feel that. And so this is a kind of an alternative, in a way, description of how suffering gets created, how our minds get caught in their own traps. And so again, this is understanding this as a process, that this description really is a kind of a very psychological description of, you know, looking at the apparatus of our you know, physiology and how it interacts with the mind, and then how that in future shapes how our physical apparatus actually receives experience. Kind of brilliant. I mean, I'm just stunned that the Buddha figured this all out 2,600 years ago. And we can see this. We can see these kinds of processes happening in our minds. And maybe not at this level of detail. Sometimes we might be able to see at this level of detail. But there are ways in which we can recognize, for instance, something like an emotion arising in our in our experience. And maybe, you know, my pointing to looking at belief, you know, looking at what's being believed, you know, that emotion arising, and emotions will contain some kind of belief. If we're really bought into the belief that's associated with that emotion, there's going to be an investment in it. And that investment will then shape how we take in the next things that we see or feel or hear. So an example of this kind of thing is that we are all familiar with is when, you know, we are caught in an aversive snit. Just in my experience, you know, the mind can easily get caught in this kind of aversive mode. And what I've noticed, particularly on retreat, but also we can notice this in daily life, is when there is that kind of a pattern in the mind, it's like it's filtering, it's shaping how we receive experience. So I myself notice that when I'm in a kind of an aversive state, my mind will be searching out things, other things to be averse to. It will tend to find the things in the environment that it doesn't like. And it will ignore the things that might, be more pleasant or soothing. It will actively seek out the things that kind of reinforce that mood. And this is a very common pattern in our minds, that when we have a particular belief or mood or state, our system seems to look for, kind of selectively pull out of the environment, things that will confirm or support that belief. That seems to be just a way our human system works. We have to actively, you know, kind of recognize that that's happening in order to kind of counter that tendency. And yet it works the other way too, in that when there's a wholesome tendency arising in the mind, you know, that when there's love or compassion or joy arising in the mind, a wholesome quality of mind, then the mind also can begin to orient towards things that will reinforce that. So it's not, again, that the mechanism in our minds is a neutral mechanism. And what, to come back to what I was talking about earlier, about the conditions that support the path, being on the path. It's like we are kind of the Buddha in his teaching, basically seeing, well, this is how the mind works, this is how conditionality works, and then watching in his own experience how the mind can lead itself towards the conditions that support freedom. Then we can cultivate those conditions. We can cultivate the views, the perspectives that support freedom. Now, this can sometimes lead people to wonder or to think, you know, well, how is this then any better? How do we know it's a better path? And the answer to that, I think, comes in our felt sense. When we are on a path, when we're on a path where delusion and ignorance and greed and aversion are driving our choices, when we're aware, when we notice what's happening, we feel the suffering of that. So our system is actually pointing out to us, this is not helpful. And the mindfulness, the practice of mindfulness begins to reveal these states of greed, aversion, confusion, as not being oriented towards well-being, not being in the direction of well-being, not on the path to well-being. Our system has no confusion about this when we see these states with wise mindfulness. There's no confusion about this. And when we see with that same kind of mindfulness, we see how being curious about, as I said earlier, you know, the path towards freedom lies in seeing, witnessing the ways in which our minds are caught, the ways in which it's kind of confusing itself, seeing that, as opposed to just being, you know, caught in that. That when we open to that with mindfulness and open to the states of heart and mind that arise with that, there is no confusion in our minds that this is a path towards well-being. And our system, our human system, to me, feels like it is oriented in the direction. It wants to find its way to well-being. And when it gets this information through this practice of wise mindfulness, when it gets the information about acting out of anger, of frustration, of greed, creates non-well-being, our system begins to reorient. It recognizes, yeah, this is not helpful. It feels the other side, the side of compassion and kindness, equanimity, as helpful. And so this is how wise view is not just another view, another kind of belief in the mind. It is used as a belief in the mind to support us to move in the direction of freedom. But the feedback that we get as we hold that view, as we explore using that view in our practice, the feedback we get is visceral. It is not, the mind is not confused about this being a useful perspective. So the question, one of the questions that came in actually kind of feels like it relates to this topic that I just was sharing. The question, how might the periodic checking, the presence of awareness, or the attitude of how we are aware be related to the factor of investigation or vichaya in the seven factors of awakening? Maybe vichaya is broader and may check on many different aspects of the experience. I'd like to hear your comments on this. My understanding, vichaya, Dhamma Vichaya, is often translated as investigation of states, investigation of experience. I think that the Vichaya is really this exploration of what is suffering and what is not suffering. So what states are suffering, what states are not suffering. So that's actually the piece that leads us on the direction towards freedom, is really having that clarity or that understanding, these states. It's interesting in the seven factors of awakening, just as a kind of a reminder, mindfulness, investigation, or this Dhamma Vichaya, energy, joy or rapture, tranquility, happiness, and equanimity. The second and third, investigation and energy, kind of overlap with the factor of right effort. It's like investigation is an activity of mind. It's a doing, or a kind of a, and it doesn't have to be a conscious doing, but it is an activity of mind to have some curiosity and investigation about what's happening in the mind and body. And the energy, the factor of the awakening factor of energy, is described elsewhere in the suttas as resulting from, as being that energy that results from having made wise effort. And so the enlightenment factor of the faculty of investigation is described that way. The faculty of energy is described that way, that it is the result of having made wise effort. And wise effort is not in the seven factors of awakening, but I think it kind of is in this aspect of Dhamma Vichaya. And so to me, this points to, again, a major part of the investigation that's pointed to in the seven factors of awakening has to do with what is suffering and what is not suffering. What is wholesome and what is unwholesome. So I think in some ways when we talk about investigation, it may be that our definition is broader in some ways, that we think about investigation as being just looking at everything. And I think in the seven factors, it may be a bit more precise towards the recognition, so what is it that leads the mind towards awakening? This is what the awakening factors are pointing to. What leads the mind towards awakening is an understanding of what's wholesome and what's unwholesome. And the recognition of that is this. Our system knows this. Again, as we explore our experience and feel into the qualities of mind that have more of the greed or the aversion or the delusion in them, there's the recognition, the feeling of the suffering of that. And that's not a mistake. That's how the practice works. And so, if you're seeing suffering with awareness, you can celebrate, because this is the mind learning that this is dukkha. And that will support the wisdom, the mind to recognize that. That is Dhamma Vichaya. That is wholesome investigation, to know this is dukkha. And the checking of the attitude is crucial in this. This piece of checking, what's the relationship to experience, will begin to reveal exactly this question. Is what's kind of motivating the mind right now, is this wholesome or unwholesome? And exposing the attitude, bringing it into consciousness, it kind of like allows it to be felt, allows it to be recognized. Maybe it was operating in the background and there was some subtle way in which there was something recognized of, this feels like something's not quite right here. And then we check the attitude. We check the attitude and we see anger or frustration or aversion, and we feel the suffering of that. Hopefully we can feel it within the context of not resisting it, where there can be some space around it. And we can begin to recognize, again, it's like even as we're feeling reactivity, we can feel the kind of spaciousness that comes with holding it with skill, with wise attitude. Right in that moment, our mind understands that the Dhamma Vichaya of that moment is recognizing, the reactivity is suffering. This holding of it is leading towards freedom. As many teachers say, this is holding of it is the kind of suffering that leads to the end of suffering. So the checking of the attitude is a crucial part of Dhamma Vichaya. I think it's kind of almost a central aspect of it, that knowing the relationship, revealing those habits and patterns. And also when we see wise attitude, we feel into that, you know, the mind being calm or curious or balanced, the mind being interested and compassionate about what's happening, that is felt as leading towards wholesomeness, and it's felt as leading towards well-being. And so again, there's not a question about that. When that is felt, our system knows this. It is not confused about this. So